Maybe just saying a little further self-introduction, because most of you are new since then. I am the son of a missionary. I spent the first 13 years of my life in Argentina, South America, where we spoke Spanish at school and German at home. And I didn't come to the States until I was 13. My father came back on furlough. And the second 13-year period in my life was spent in the USA. That's when I started with English. And the third of my life was spent in Hong Kong, about 15 years. So that's where my accent comes from, not having spoken English till I was 14. People have judged it to be Dutch independently. I don't know how they arrive at that, but anyway, it often bugs people when just accent of that fellow. If it does, now I know what it is. This topic of worker priests, I'm going to introduce by simply narrating to you a series of events in Hong Kong that brought us to the point of having worker priests. Then I will mention very briefly how in other parts of the world, for different reasons and in different circumstances, they arrived at a similar experiment. And then I will throw it open to questions. I hope that at least half of this time from now till 4 will be on sharing, expressing opinions. In 1971 in Hong Kong, in our seminary, we had a student strike. We thought that we were on the vanguard of the church, really leading in every way, and here suddenly the faculty felt very embarrassed, hiding our heads in shame, because the people in church could say, look, your seminary isn't even united, faculty and students. Here you have a student strike, which is not that much heard of in the Orient. The issue supposedly was student aid, but the students were already getting twice as much student aid as the average university student who was fortunate enough to get student scholarship from the government. So we knew that basically there was something wrong, and we had many clues that led us to believe this. That basically the impression was that the students felt that the church in America was so loaded with money and so anxious to have preachers in Hong Kong that it would surely yield to their request for more money, because we couldn't possibly think of doing anything else. Especially we wanted to be quiet, you know, not to publicize strikes in the church. And we also recognized that this failure was not something that we should hold in judgment over them. It was a failure of us missionaries. Somehow we had conveyed to them an image of a ministry which was way off the concept of dedication and discipleship that we see in the New Testament. If we did some plain figuring, we knew that if we simply give them all that salary or that additional student aid, they would simply become more fussy students with a higher standard of living which the congregations could never possibly support when they graduate. And when they graduate, they'd be very fussy students. The congregations were already subsidized, and after 15, 20 years, most of them were still 80% subsidized. And so if we churned out 5 graduates per year for the next 10, 15 years, we would probably end up with a subsidy bill 20 times higher than what we had, instead of going towards self-support, which should be our goal. So for these reasons, we felt it wiser not to immediately just give them the money, although we could have done so and just, you know, you can always dress up reports back home and then leave 5 years later, and then it's somebody else's problem. A lot of that has been done. But ultimately, we are not responsible to mission boards. We are responsible to our God and to history, if you will, that will judge us and whether or not things we did to make the moment more easy and more bearable were right in the long run. So we asked the students, how about waiting for a month, go back to classes, and then we'll have a retreat, 3-day retreat, away from the seminary, to get away from the atmosphere of teacher-student relationships. And the faculty already was outnumbered by the students, so we agreed, let's just vote, everybody votes together, students and faculty. But we're going to bind ourselves to a few basic ground rules. And these proved crucial. We finally did have our meeting a month later, 3 full days, which were probably the most exhaustive days in my whole life. After 2.5 days of this retreat, we still got no place, because the students felt very sure that the only solution lay simply in giving them the money they wanted, so that they would be getting about 3 times instead of twice as much as the average university student was getting scholarships. But we tried to show them that one of the ground rules was our short-term solution should not aggravate the long-term solution. And if we did that, the long-term solution would be chaotic. The church couldn't possibly handle its economic situation. And so finally the students came with a counter-proposal, something like this, asking whether or not the church would assist them in various ways, I won't go into, but assist them in retraining themselves in another employment, while they at the same time were not ready to give up this going to the seminary to become pastors. They realized now that they had come into the seminary and with some very warped, strange ideas about what a minister should be. And yet there was enough genuineness in their call that they wanted to continue it. It wasn't all phony. So it was a joint proposal, unanimously passed there, after all these tensions for 2.5 days. We submitted this proposal jointly to the seminary board, and the seminary board had to accept it. What could it do? It couldn't fire the students for such a reasonable request. It couldn't import a student body just to give the appearance to boards there and here that things are going as usual, that we have a full-time seminary student body. So the seminary board accepted it and passed it on to the church on the same terms, and the church likewise accepted it. Nobody, however, dreamt it meant much more inconvenience, since most of the classes were held evenings from now on. And it's something nice, very cozy about having a seminary scheduled from 8 in the morning till 5 in the evening, and having the evening. And we sure heard about it at home. And even more significant than that is that the planning for each class had to be far more detailed, because the ratio between class hours and homework hours had to be changed. We couldn't simply offer as many classes on evenings as you had for a full-time student body. And it's meant that we had to have more homework. In order to make sure that they did their homework, you had to find sophisticated ways of making sure they did their homework without occupying too much of your class time, which was so valuable. Every minute had to be planned, which, again, was a very useful thing, but work, inconvenience. There are a number of surprises which we ran into, namely that soon after this, those students applying for entrance into our seminary program,
I don't know what is going on.
I think they're putting logs up there, aren't they, for this?
Why don't you look for curiosity's sake?
That's what they're doing.
They're not tearing the building down, it's all right.
If it helps any, it's logs. For some reason, we never really pushed this in terms of recruitment, but this level, the average of students applying for entry into our seminary program went up by about 3 years, academic equivalency. Some of them were with bachelor's degrees, some even with master's degrees. And to this day, we haven't gotten around to writing a recruitment brochure. We've been so busy just catching up with all the other work required by this. Well, this is one of the routes we went into. Then in Hong Kong, the reason for us going the route of worker priests was economic, plainly economic. And the reason why we had to take that step is because our history was one of a church that was a church of refugees. They got a lot of subsidy, and some of this crept into the clergy of our church because they often were in control of the subsidy funds, and they often could have church budgets, but of which the church chairman never got to see the budget because they had these subsidies coming so easily. And so we have gotten ourselves into a little bit of a mess, the whole question of dependence, and somehow this was the crisis that forced us out of it. The solution came from the students themselves. Without any of them having been trained or coached, they practically described what is a textbook definition of a worker priest. The pace of change surprised us because we thought that now we'll have these full-time first, now it'll be another 2-3 years, and then later on we would have a part-time program. But the students soon changed their request. They said, could we already now start in our subsidiary employment training while taking the seminary courses on a part-time basis? We had no objection to that because it simplified the matter for us. We could then immediately start getting new students instead of running one program full-time, the other one part-time, and doing both poorly. This way we could do one of the two and do it better. So the reason for us taking this route in Hong Kong was basically economic. But it needn't always be economic. The history of the worker priest movement in France shows that economics had nothing to do with it at all. In France, there were priests of the Roman Catholic Church who felt there was such a wide gap between the Church of Rome and the blue-collar workers that they just weren't communicating at all. And they asked for permission from their superiors to go and work in these factories, getting dirty, working the same blue uniforms that everybody else wore, and while on the job, tried to be a priest to the persons next to them, and of course outside the job also have masses and this sort of thing, and be involved in labor union dialogue, that sort of thing. Now, these priests got so involved in the concerns of these blue-collar workers that they became what the church felt was dangerously leftist. Some of them turned communist. And soon the church outlawed the experiment as being too dangerous. However, about 20 years later, the Roman Catholic Church has come around to the point not only of saying it was okay, but being proud of that experiment. This regularly happens when you have a new movement in history. Although the worker priest movement is by no means a new movement. This is, in this particular shape, it was new in France then, around World War II. So there, the main reason was not economic, communication, if you will. Solving a communication gap between the church and the laboring masses. In still another part of the world, Central and South America, the worker-priest movement grew, mushroomed, but the reason there was not economic, it wasn't cultural, it was plainly a problem of geography. that the places that needed to be served by too few priests or too few Protestant clergymen were so far apart that the people had to do pretty much what St. Paul did, train elders in these different places, and maybe go a step further, bringing the seminary libraries and some of the seminary courses to them, rather than taking them out of their situations and taking them to the seminary to live an isolated life. This meant that the faculty had to become a moving faculty, moving around the countryside. I'm not going into what is called theological education by extension, but we are more concerned now in the result of that, namely what is called the worker priest movement. So you hear the reason was geographic. In France it was cultural, if you will. In Hong Kong it was economic. And we should be very careful when we talk about the worker priest movement to be sure that we are not taking it only for economic reasons, because if that is our only reason, then it's on very thin ice. Well, my object was now to introduce the question of the worker priest, and at this point I'd like to suggest some possible questions or areas for discussion, and you take off wherever you want to. One of the big questions is, if we're going to have worker priests, what should be their relation to the church, specifically their job description, their frame of reference? For example, can you envision a worker priest doing an acceptable job, being in charge of an entire church, and do it adequately? Or do you see it only as having a role if you have a team? If a worker priest is a part of a team of other worker priests, maybe one or two full-time workers besides. If you're going to have both full-time and part-time worker priests, what should be the proportion between them? Can this worker priest business can be a thing that's going to get out of hand? Supposing you have only, for every 10 worker priests, you have one full-time clergyman. Or should it be 5 for every one? Or 2-1, or 1-1? Another question. Church government. Should they be allowed the same type of vote as a full-time clergyman? Especially if they outnumber, if the worker priests outnumber the full-time clergymen. This may not be a very hot question for you people, but believe me, it is for clergymen usually. If they find that they're suddenly outnumbered by all kinds of part-time worker priests. This is something that merits discussion. Another question. If you have worker priests, should they be totally volunteer, or should the arrangement, this relationship, somehow be sealed by a contract which may involve payment? Another question would be, maybe some of you have doubts whether or not we should even be worker priests. And should we discuss what are the Bible and church history precedents for worker priests? Did Christ not tell his disciples to leave their nets behind? And that means that Christ is really not in favor of worker priests. So put. Okay, let's take it up at this point. Pick up any of these questions, or don't just address them to me, address them to the whole group. Maybe we should start off by having different people say different types of worker priests that you know of. In Hong Kong, we now have, among the students that are becoming worker priests, we have social worker, nurse, teachers, principals of high schools, a factory manager,
electronics factory manager. A public land surveyor, an accountant. These are all work appraisals. A church secretary, yes.
In Arizona, in a small parish that is isolated from anybody, you know, that could come in. They had this worker priest combination for the worker, for the priest, for the pastor. He was a seminary, but he, I think, worked for a supermarket for full time, and he was the only pastor in the parish. But evidently, it didn't seem to work out. Maybe he was too tired when he was too carrying boxes and stuff from the supermarket, so he didn't have enough energy left to do his other work.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only experiment I think they've had in Arizona. So I think they've gone away from it now, and he has a two-point parish instead, even though they aren't that far. But far as the students are concerned, do you require a college degree from the students that you have in your seminary?
No. We require that they have an employment, the income of which would compare with the income of a clergyman. So that in a Hong Kong situation, this may not make sense here, but in a Hong Kong situation, no one goes into the ministry because it's an easier job and for an easy life.
No, but I mean,
now,
if you get into the seminary,
yes,
you have to have any college work.
No, he only has to have an employment. Now, this means, for example, that one person who is applying right now is a welder, who is a very gifted labor union leader there, but his education is, well, he hasn't finished high school, but I believe he has the ability to go considerably beyond that. But his income as a welder is more than that of a clergyman, and that certainly removes more money as a possible motive for entering the ministry. And I think it's a healthy thing to have someone like that around to pull us down to more sensible language and the like. So the only requirement is an employment or qualification for employment in occupation, the income of which compares favorably with the income of a clergyman in Hong Kong. Yes?
At Seward Concordia, our worker priest situation is still a little bit different in the fact that the individual is trained to be a teacher. He probably will end up teaching in a public school and then serve a congregation that doesn't have a school or which could not employ him because of economics in this case again. The smaller parishes, for example, places in Wyoming, I remember cases like that, where the individual would take the position of the high school teacher. And this arrangement would be made with the public school and the local congregation in such a way that he would, at least get the major part of his salary from teaching in the public school, but then do the congregational work of a what we now call a BCE, Director of Christian Education. It may be in a case like that, but like in Arizona, where there are one pastor who has two or three parishes, this individual might actually also conduct or be there for various meetings, like even the Women's Missionary League or the Women's Aid or the weekday schools, confirmation classes, you know, the dozens of other kinds of meetings that the pastor wouldn't have the time to be there for.
Mm-hmm.
So his work would be sort of split. In many of the smaller congregations like that, there may not be enough people either for that matter, to pay him a salary along with the pastor's salary. So we call that kind of situation a worker priest.
Mm.
In a sense, he is kind of like this public school teacher who serves on various boards and committees of the congregation, except that in this case he is definitely called to that being trained for it. And he does have the status of a Lutheran teacher, such as a graduate of Concordia. They have no problem with voting, because teachers aren't allowed to vote anyway, so this is a sore thumb for us, of course. But so it doesn't bother anybody. And in fact, in the Missouri Senate, this wouldn't bother anybody, because any congregation has only two votes.
Yeah.
One from the clergy, and it doesn't have to be, it can be anybody from the clergy, and one from the layman. So whoever the clergy is, they choose one. And actually, in our district, in the Nebraska district, we end up with having laymen outnumber the pastors.
Mm-hmm.
Many congregations are vacant,
yeah.
And many are, and so you do have many more laymen than you have clergy.
Could you, yes, and after this question, could you maybe, as a stage one, hear from as many people who would like to share about different types of worker priests that you know, so we get an overall idea. And then maybe at stage two, let's talk about the pros and cons as you see them. And for example, where it failed, what could possibly be the reason for it, and what conclusion may or may not draw from it? Yes.
We have a son who is a worker priest in the southern part of California. And he came into this type of a work relationship through a very beautiful way. He was the vicar of the vicar in this parish prior to his graduation. And then, since he was a graduate of Seminex, this particular congregation, although it was had not really gone the route of being labeled either moderate or conservative, wished to ensure his being able to serve in the ministry. And on this account, they then offered him this call as a worker priest. The reason they did this was because in their budget terms, they were not prepared to pay his salary, and for the time being, he would have to contribute to it. The kind of work that he was involved in doing was a counselor for some disturbed youth. This took up a great deal of his time, as he soon discovered, and it was during the hours of about 3 in the afternoon to 11 o'clock at night, which meant that he was not able to participate in a lot of the youth activities or a lot of the evening meetings, which is a very essential part of the congregation. It also meant that he worked, I think, on Saturday nights very frequently, and also on Sunday afternoons and evenings. I think John, in hearing him speak of this, spoke of some frustration, because he would have liked to have involved a little bit more with the youth of the parish, and also he found out that the work he had made him very, very fatigued. It was emotionally exciting, but it was also emotionally fatiguing. But in the meantime, this congregation has been working toward providing more of his salary, so that now he is working at the point where he only has to contribute about 20 hours a week and a salary, and not at the prime parish time. But he was just again an assistant to a strong pastor, so it worked out well for him.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that you start out with a weak arrangement does not prevent the thing from growing, possibly even into a full-time relationship eventually.
True, but I do think that John feels it's a very important kind of relationship to have, because he feels that he can dialogue with the members of the parish in a different way, when he can say, you know, I also am working, and I'm not only getting support from you, but I'm also working to contribute.
Here, Mike, this illustrates a point, and then I'll get to your question. In Hong Kong, we found that and the classes that we graduated, those that were potential worker priests were also the ones that were academically at the top. And they were snapped up immediately by congregations for calls, not only because they were financially less of a burden, but they performed better. And that meant that the bottom of the class lay there without calls, and they kept complaining and saying, the church must be just, fair. And what is seminary training? It's an indictment of seminary training if you have a graduate that doesn't get a call. And so the result was, everybody knew it, eventually the church, the general synod, would extend a call to that person. And we somehow arrived at a pattern where those who were full-time workers were the ones that were less able. And those who were part-time were the ones that were gifted. Now the point at which this really becomes a rub is if you evolve team ministries where you would think that the best thing would be for the full-time person to be the team leader. If, however, that team leader who is full-time happens to be the one who everybody knows academically and otherwise is less gifted than the others, particularly Asian situation, it makes it very difficult to get full cooperation. Now we are trying through a long-range program to invert the whole thing. Step one being that we are not against full-time clergy. Anything worth doing is worth doing full-time. If there's anything that's worth doing, it is a ministry. But we want that the image of the ministry becomes a better one than what it is now in Hong Kong, without going into these constant tirades of, you know, running down the ministry. How do you somehow get out of this jam we're in? We think that out of every 10 or 15 worker priests we have, there may evolve two or three who will do their job particularly well. And we already have this happening in a few cases, where the people who are doing the thing on a part-time basis would like to do it more, and the congregations they're serving say, we like what you're doing, we'd like you to do it full-time, not just part-time. And over a period varying from a few months to a few years, there evolves a mutual call, if you will, where eventually the person becomes full-time. But even though he could earn his income at another job, no, he wants to do this so much, he will do it, and the congregation will stand up behind him. And by that process, we will get people who are full-time, not by default, but because they do it well. And that hopefully will change the image of what full-time clergymen are in Hong Kong and inspire young people to go into seminary studies for better motives, we hope, than those that we've had 10 years ago. So a little bit the same thing that happened there with John. Okay.
Well, I served for the past 3 years as a worker pastor, and I never intend going back into the full-time ministry again. There are many situations in the church where it's just impossible for our congregation to support the traditional ministry, and yet they are as entitled to a trained leader serving the congregation as any other group of Christians. So what I did is I finally badgered my synodical authority into proposing to a struggling mission congregation that wasn't meeting the expectations of the National Mission Board. And I went in there on a 3-month trial basis, but I experimented how what the ministry to this small congregation would be like if I were working part-time for the congregation and part-time doing something else, even though I didn't have a job at that time. And the congregation decided after 3 months that their needs would be met very adequately with the leadership that a pastor could provide. In that same time, they had some benefits to provide to the pastor in that they had a parsonage where he could live. And we worked out an agreement. And the congregation provided parsonage, utilities, pension, that kind of package, but no salary. And then it was up to me to find a job. And I finally found a job teaching accounting at a university 8 miles away. And I taught for 2 academic years there. Unfortunately, the department grew to the point that they needed to add 2-time full-time faculty, so they didn't need me. And so we then had to move into a traditional full-time ministry with mission board support, and it just wasn't the same. After 9 months, I resigned, and setting up this kind of relationship with another congregation. with a slight emphasis, change in emphasis, in that at the beginning there's going to be some underwriting of the pastor of a salary until that time that he can find a job. And then with the option is that with a, if without sacrificing the work in the congregation, it is possible to move into a tent maker ministry. There will be the authority both from the national church and from the synod and from the congregation to go ahead and do this. And that's the kind of a call that their, this congregation will be voting next Sunday, whether they want to embark on this or not. Mm-hmm. But I tell you, this is the first time I understood what Luther talked about when he talked about the universal priesthood of believers. Because I go to a council meeting, and you pastors, you can just eat your hearts out now, I tell you. But something would come up, and one of the first things they'd say is, well, who's going to do it? Pastor can't do it. And the development of lay leadership in this congregation in 3 years was fantastic. And the climax of it was, right before I left, we had vacation church school. And a woman who, when I first came, said, I could never teach, just astounded me. She walked up to the one in charge of the vacation church school and said, could I teach a class this year? Now, she's completely unaware of the growth that's happened in that 3-year period. The leadership of the church was turned over right to the laity. In the LCA policy, the pastor is usually the president of the congregation. First thing we did was amend the constitution, put a layman in there. And the three men who served as president of the congregation now are so, before they were, oh, somewhat interested in the church. And now they're all on fire and they're all capable. And they, the only thing, the stipulation that I made to the president of the synod, I said, whatever you do, please, please, please don't recommend to this congregation a pastor who has to do everything himself. Because all he'll do is pull everything back out of the hands of the laity into his own little empire. And leave these people who develop this talent and this willingness to serve high and dry. But it's tremendous. And I'll never go back.
Are you married?
Yes, I'm married.
How do you?
I have a wife, two children.
Thank you. Well, what I'm getting at is to what extent did the burden of having both the job and the church strain your obligations for time for the family, wife and children?
Oh, I was freer to do things with them.
I don't know, maybe she should answer it.
I think I'd say sort of the same thing, that the compulsion of expectation from congregation to be at their beck and call every minute was gone.
Uh-huh.
So we really felt free to just be a family any way we wanted to, and I don't think we were, irreverent about it. I mean, the church matters, everything to both of us. But I mean, I felt that I had him more at home, or more free to concentrate on home, because he felt freer not to go to all the meetings or not to have to be responsible for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, teaching was different. This was teaching. It was, it wasn't actually 8 hours. It took a lot of time to prepare for it, but it wasn't as if it had been this other job you're talking about of 8 hours every day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
good. We've had several different examples. Can we hear from a few more that... Yes.
We don't know either the individual or the situations in which he's worked well enough to speak with authority, but the only one we've known has been Pastor Thorson's type of a... an ordained pastor who chose to be a tent maker minister and went out and got a job in the market.
Uh-huh.
And he worked for a time in a position in a wholesale plumbing firm, and he's worked as a supervisor in the housing project and this type of thing, and then has carried on a part-time ministry.
Mm-hmm.
I would just wonder how a person who has been geared professionally, morally and ethically in every way in a particular professional area, and then to have some other job. Or sometimes, it's easy to say, I want to get out of this, and I want to do, plumbing or whatever. But, I would think that the other job that you'd have would also have to be something in which you could develop your own, which you see as your prime interest. you know, like to be a worker priest and then to be, you know, some flunky job. I would think
that could vary with an individual. I know physicians who love to do woodwork and who love to garden, but, you know, not everyone does. And again, there are people who have, we happen to have a pastor right now who is a tremendously good mechanic. I mean, he just loves to work with old cars, and this could be a possibility of an interest combination.
I just have a couple of comments here. One thought came to me as I was listening to you, that at the time that the worker priest idea was abandoned in Turkey, of course, this wasn't the Christian type of ministry, but anyway, when the priests ceased being teachers there of reading and writing to the people, the church died, you know, because the people could still go and say their prayers in the mosques and so on, but there was no vitality or no learning, nor any specific gain that was taking place which would enhance their living and their lives. So that thought struck me while I was listening. When the Hoja just then became, he just sort of was a figure around the temple or around the mosque, then, you know, there, I would say that in Turkey nowadays, the church is, you know, it is really dead. And that, of course, is not the Christian church, but the Christian church is working a little bit underground, mm-hmm. and they have the worker priests, mm-hmm. In a manner of speaking. But that was just a thought. Then another thing is, it seems to me that the priest whose life confronts the same types of tensions and the same types of demands of the 8-hour workaday world, such as we all confront, can deal as a religious advisor and as a priest and as a friend even, on a much more honest basis. And I personally would appreciate this. You know, that is not to put the pastor down who has kind of kept an ivory tower existence in many cases. No offense, you people. But it really does seem to me, and has on occasions, that the priest in my life didn't know really what was, you know, what was required of the people who had to maintain the workaday world and deal with that type of life and still give a generous portion of time and energy and talent, even when they were tired, you know, even when they're really just spent, to the church, quotation marks. And since we are, you know, all priests, I think the credibility factor would be worth the experiment alone. The fact that, you know, my priest is, I know he's working, you know, at something, gainfully employed, so to speak, but also dedicated to the propagation of the gospel and to all the services and to all the things that go with that. And now that we have in America, you know, I know nothing of Hong Kong and so on, but when we have a literate population where the word is open to us, you know, we don't need a translator in the sense that was needed, say, 50, 60 years ago or longer ago, then this suggests to me a real vitality. I don't know how it can be worked, but it's a very interesting concept.
Mary, I believe you wanted to say something.
Well, I was just thinking that I don't know whether you touched on this, because I didn't get here at the very beginning and I couldn't hear too well, so I came in from the church. When this movement started in France and in Germany, particularly in France, this was the reason for it. It wasn't because they couldn't support the church, it was because France was going so completely pivot, and particularly in the laboring classes in the factories, and where the worker priest had specific value was not in the middle class, but with the in the factories. Now, I don't know how many of these priests are working in factories. I mean, the identity to offset the Marxist, real pull with the laboring classes. This started. Of course, it was put down by the hierarchy eventually. But that was the point of it. Now, I think what interested me in the Hong Kong situation was that it was such a natural thing to do. It came, as you said, normal kind of development. But what they did in France was an attack, a strategy. Now, it had the same reasoning as the lady who spoke last had, but it was on a far, farther down level in terms of the working areas.
I'd just like to take off one word that you said, that it came kind of naturally in Hong Kong. I'll say yes, but if you define naturally as not meaning necessarily without conflict. Yeah, and I'd like to expand on that a little bit. It started out, we were surprised how little opposition there was to the idea, and it seemed that the older clergy in Hong Kong, those whom we would have expected to object to it, didn't. And it became apparent that they treated these new graduates as cheap labor. They were doing more work than the full-time pastors. So after 2-3 years, some of these who were being worker priests, some of them even volunteer priests, started expressing dissatisfaction. They wanted to strike out on their own. And at that point, when the conflict became more intense, because some of those who did, being worker priests and working only 1/3 of the time, maybe less, were doing a better job than some of the full-time clergymen. Of course, there were exceptions too. And this caused a number of contradictions, conflicts in the church. Suddenly, those who were in favor of it earlier started being against it. But by that time, we had found out a little bit about their own background too. Those, for example, a number of pastors who own apartments or little shops as a sideline, who are vigorously against the concept of worker priests. Now, some of the property they own, they very shrewdly own in their wife's name in Hong Kong. It's a kind of surrogate. We definitely have conflict emerging. The one time when we were particularly thankful for having worker priests in Hong Kong is in 1974, when we had some really wild politics going on, and particularly people who are heavily on subsidy are vulnerable to deals made in tea houses in Hong Kong. That's where all the deals are made. Everybody knows in advance what the vote will be like. But on the night before the elections, in April 1974, that one group already had a victory party. They said they had 38 votes out of 57 in the bag. But the next day when the elections were held, a few things came out in the open about shenanigans going on, secret correspondence between a minority there and people here in the States, and about 8 to 12 worker priests were the main ones who shifted their votes because they were not umbilically dependent on that subsidy and they could vote according to their conscience. And I shudder to think what would have happened if those deals had worked out. So we had a few surprises like that. And maybe one other point I should make is now in Hong Kong, these people whom we are training to be worker priests, they will be ready to go to China if and when it opens up. If China ever opens up, we are almost sure the old line of full-time missionary or full-time Chinese pastor will not be accepted. It has to be somebody who can perform some sort of a manual or intellectual service which will benefit the material society. And
This means that we are preparing them for that already, although we cannot take credit that we planned it that way. We went into it backwards, and God pushed us that way. But we like to think that it is an objective. We are not kidding ourselves also that they will all go into China if and when an opportunity arises. But we can't possibly train a whole army of preachers in Hong Kong who are full-time and who are waiting to go into China, and while they're waiting, they have to be subsidized. They're going to become corrupt through that sort of process. You know? Yeah. So these are a few more details concerning the background of our unique situation in Hong Kong, which may not be at all the case here.
I'm studying for the ministry in the Missouri Synod at the moment, and when I first heard about worker priests, it struck me that that might be a possibility for women in ministry in a church like the Missouri Synod. It would allow a congregation to open itself up to a woman's ministry without really committing themselves to it 100%.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ministry of worker priest to the church and not to society so much.
A long process of educating the church that it's needed.
Do you actually call that worker priests if the missionary or the priest's wife owns the apartments and runs them?
Well, let's put it this way. When we investigated the question, we had a study that some students made, and they had an awful time getting at, defining what is a worker priest and under what conditions can loopholes be used.
Well, it seems to me that if the wife is running the apartments, that's no different than what we have in Arizona. There are many of the ALC pastors' wives that work full time.
Okay, some people may say eliminate that, but we have reason to believe that the income which some of our clergymen are getting there is being rerouted into ownership of apartments, which in turn are rented out for income greater than what they're getting. So, okay, I accept that that it may not be valid to be on dangerous ground if we judge too much there.
I see the difference being where if you're being subsidized and you're getting the salary to be a full-time pastor, and instead you're using that subsidy to in other words, your time, to make gainful employment outside, then
This is a little bit of what's happening in Hong Kong, and what you're saying is correct. It may not apply here.
Didn't I understand you to say that such people who were doing that kind of a deal were against the worker priest concept?
I was pointing out that there was a contradiction. That they were, for example, one pastor I know, he owns an apartment. He has to spend time seeing that the toilets flush and this sort of stuff. You know, it's not a worker priest in the sense that he punches in time, but it's a responsibility. It takes time at all kinds of hours. And it provides income for him.
But he's still a full-time pastor on subsidy. That's what you're talking about.
Okay, you're saying two things there. People may argue whether or not he's full-time. Oh, he's supposed to be full-time.
He's supposed to be.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
He's not a worker priest.
Yeah.
Okay.
He could make himself a worker priest if he turned off his subsidy.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be a valid type of worker priest.
Yeah.
Shift from one to the other.
I don't want to obligate any of you to stay here. Let's put it this way. Any of you who want to go eat, go right now, okay? And let's say that we'll extend this by 15 minutes, okay? And then I think...
What are you going to do? Are you going to do the alternate seminary education one too?
Not now, no. No, no, this is not. No, not today, no.
I have to go and check and see if they are running. If they're running out of, if they need people, I'll stay. And if they don't, then I'll come back.
Okay.
How many do you have in the center?
We have 34 students. All of them, of course, part time. But some of the very gifted ones, they can assume loads approaching full time. Yes.
Well, what if the distinction should be made between a priest worker and a worker priest? I think the difference is fundamental to the whole issue of how diluted the concept of a ministry will get.
Would you
really
care
to... Really all you have is lay people. I mean, under the guise of a minister, where really you will have, you know, the priest who also happens to work, as opposed to a person who works. People are human, and they can only be stretched so far.
Mm-hmm.
Something will not get done when a person is doing both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it would seem that the difference of whether the worker and also a priest, or a priest and also a worker, the difference would be would appear, as it would seem to me, fundamental to what the primary motivating factor is, and where the primary allegiance would lie. If a person had to take time off from work because he had a particular problem, okay, and if that's the way that the call would be made in every judgment, as opposed to the other way, then you'd seem that, you know, it would work. But if you're, the person's materialistic duties, if you will, are going to take away from priestly duties, then it would seem like it would be counterproductive to the ultimate objective.
I have kind of deliberately stayed away from the business of defining, because defining the terms, because the more I've gone into this, you get to chase your tail a lot, and it can be very time-consuming and in some ways confusing. But I think one thing regarding definition of worker priest perhaps should be clarified, that many of the cases where a person is worker priest, he's not just a worker priest, a priest worker, in the hours outside of that full-time job. But the place where he is working is, and the time when he is doing that, quote, secular work, that is his arena where he also does some of his pastoring. For example, truck driving ministry. Somebody has a restaurant for truck drivers. And it's not that when he gets off of that job, or like these worker priests in France when they worked in the factories, they're, being a worker priest didn't begin when they punched that time card and left the factory. But they considered the factory itself to be the place where they're making not house calls, but counseling and what else.
Their parish.
So if you operate with that kind of distinction, then it's a little bit harder to start drawing these lines. Maybe that's what you were trying to do, I'm not sure.
Well, what I hear is an awful lot of the outside duties and how it, I guess, relieves the financial burden on the parish.
Uh-huh.
I haven't heard anything about the concern for how the parish may be losing as a result of this.
Uh-huh.
And there was the financial advantages of going this way seem to be getting much more of the emphasis than perhaps the, you know, why shouldn't, you know, what are the negatives for this?
Yes.
Isn't there a possibility, too, that the two positions can't, are complementary in such a way that they improve the other, so that the...
Which two positions do you mean?
I mean the priest duties and then the secular duties, or the two positions, so that both of them can be enhanced. I think one of the problems in 20th century society is that our heads and our hands become so divorced that both aspects of us lose out because there's no connection. Whereas in something like this, the head is at work and the hand is at work. And I think that they can work from that kind of...
I myself started a new congregation at a summer during a summer job which I had in my seminary days. And I was working about 60 hours a week at the factory, rock wool factory for insulation. And through a vacation Bible school, started a church there, and some of my most creative thinking for sermons was done in the assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a small, I don't want to press this too far, but it is possible to do a lot of things which, while you're doing manual labor, which doesn't require a thinking, for which otherwise you have time set aside.
That's one of the emphases in Holden, too. Combining the work and the mental work and the imagination, you know, so that the person doesn't become segmented into a bunch of little different areas, but can become unified again. And that, too, is the emphasis of the lifestyle program. All aspects of a person are emphasized, and the unity of those different aspects is emphasized. think that's really important.
I guess the concept is really thrilling. I don't know whether it can be practically worked out, but I think it's just a thrilling idea to me.
By the way, one other thing, it's worth mentioning that one full-time clergyman mentioned the other day, speaking for his full-time profession, he was saying that so many full-time clergymen are so busy with administration, when the real job they should be doing, pastoring, including, of course, visitation, sermon preparation, counseling, and the scholarly work that goes behind that all, that they're at best doing that half-time. And so, functionally speaking, most full-time pastors already are part-time pastors and a kind of worker priest.
No. I'm sure that's probably true.
Now he was,
and therefore, delegate out and take out the kind of assistance and help within the congregation to do some of these other things. You know, in other words, he's the one who's responsible for not being so totally bogged down with the secondary matters of administration or whatever. I think that's a kind of a challenge as a clergy person, to not busy yourself so much in the things that fill up time and seem to be productive. And maybe there we can bring in our lay people and still retain our full clergy status.
Yes.
In Hong Kong, when the student days are over, does that person, worker, priest, become ordained at that point? Or isn't there any ordination involved anywhere along the line?
Now, there may or may not be ordination. In other words, the pressure we formerly had to ordain all the graduates is all gone now. We have a number of graduates who now, 3 or 4 years after graduation, still haven't received the call, and now we are not experiencing the pressure, or if we are, we are certainly not yielding to it. And so we are having, from every seminary class that graduates, some who get called and ordained, some who do not, and in a few cases there may be people who will work and functionally do what a clergyman may do. It may even be a woman that is not ordained as a woman but does a lot of the work that a clergyman would otherwise be doing. And,
without ordination.
So it's something between, yeah.
I'd like to speak a little of what John's concern there as to, you know, which comes first. The role as pastor, I think, or the other work. This is one place where I took issue with the leadership of the church because their first concern was, well, now how are you going to find employment that's appropriate to your calling? Well, the job is a means to an end. It doesn't become the end in itself. Once it becomes an end in itself, then you've lost purpose of the idea of the tent maker pastor. I prefer the term tent maker pastor. Priest, I'm uncomfortable with this concept. So. But my job, whatever it may be, is simply the means to bringing the church's ministry to people who could otherwise not get it. And I see my role in most instances for the rest of my life as simply filling in at times in the life of a congregation between its beginning and the time when it becomes fully self-sufficient. So this kind of is an intermediate step here, which enables the congregation to have a full-time ministry during the period of growth up to the point where it can operate on its own. My task would be to really do myself out of a job. Getting to the point where a tent maker could no longer handle it, you would need a full-time man, and they could support a full-time man. But the thing that gets me is I don't see any realistic understanding on the part of the leaders of the church for the fact that with the rising inflation, more and more congregations are going to be in the category of those who are no longer able to support the full-time traditional ministry. And we're going to have to find alternatives. And I don't see that very much of the leadership in the church in America is in favor. In fact, I received a call from the parish to come as tent maker pastor, I accepted and I moved in. It took the church at large 4 months to determine the propriety of that call, and finally the synod had to issue me a call to special service so that the LCA office in New York would agree that I had a correct call in which I could serve. In the meantime, I've been serving it all the time. Yeah. So So when it was, the only thing I did with that call is that when I did finally resign the congregation's call, I sent a copy to the synod and said, I guess this takes care of your call too. But it's the church at large, I don't think is sympathetic to anything except the traditional ministry, and my suspicion of it is, and I'll throw it in and I'll keep my mouth shut, I suspect that they're afraid that if the pastor has other additional sources of income, he will not then be as dependent upon the church pension system. He will not then be as beholden to the hierarchy, and he may do some independent thinking and voting. Now, I tend to be cynical.
Could I ask one question at this point, because it relates to his contribution? Two things. First of all, do you envision this just as implementing a ministry to the parishes that can't afford a pastor? I see it as a real exciting idea to a parish that has had only one motive for years and years and years, and that's supporting, well, a pastor.
Right, right.
That's all we've ever done. Our parish has supported a pastor very well, you know. He's lived well, all never worried about getting paycheck, and no one has ever begrudged him anything, but that's all we've done. Our contribution plus a very small benevolence to the district, you know, we do nothing really, and we're a metropolitan parish. And I look at that and I keep thinking, my goodness, all of our resources are contributed here. Our annual budget is $53,000, the great preponderance of which goes to the cost of the clergy. And I think, you know, here we are, several hundred people, and that's a, in a way, kind of a pathetic evangelism. And, you know, we come an hour a Sunday and sit together, and then we go, a few of us come back Tuesday nights for our committee meetings and so on. Fewer yet come back Thursday nights.
Then somebody's not doing their job, it sounds like to me.
I think that's what's great about the concept of the church, is the church is the people, not the pastor. I mean, the pastor is
well,
not the church, but the church is the
but
people.
But the whole program is, you work on what it's, you know, what the parish can do. And the parish has done this much. That's what it's doing now.
And how often does the congregation, I wonder, feel free to examine, investigate, criticize in a positive or negative way the work that its pastor or pastors are doing, because the congregation...
Well, I don't think there's any criticism necessary. We have a traditional congregation in the truest sense of the word. The pastor image does all the right things, you know.
But the congregation, if anybody's going to change it, might it not be the congregation?
Has the congregation ever thought of supporting a missionary?
No, only briefly. You know, I don't think we can afford to support a missionary with our membership. Our membership hasn't been growing that much. You see, we've gotten to a point now where all we can do is support a full-time pastor. There's really not a lot left over. At the present time, in this August, end of August, we have kept up on expenses, we have paid off a mortgage on the church building, and we have paid, I think, maybe something like $60 or maybe a little better this year toward the district benevolence.
Sounds like you can afford to support your pastor. The way you're going. You shouldn't afford to support.
Well, this is what I say.
I wonder if...
Can I add one thing here?
Okay.
So what happened to this congregation? For one thing, when they didn't have to be paying the pastor, it freed up more money for enriching the congregation program. And so education thrived a little bit more because there was some money to do some of the...
You're talking about your congregation.
Yes, in this tent maker thing, see. Benevolence went way up. The response to the World Hunger Appeal.
Yeah.
All we did was tell them, hey, you know, we're doing real well here, and there are people who are starving to death. And at the beginning, if they were going to be, before it was all over, contributing $600 a year to World Hunger, this little group of people, no one would ever believe it.
But well, we spent $700 on a dinner for our congregational dinner last year, $700, and we sent about 169 to World Hunger. Well, I confess this to you. I'm not bragging about it, you know. And it is true, I can, to defend myself, I guess I can say I tried in my own little way to, you know, to make some changes. But basically the traditional parish supporting a full-time pastor in this way is not ever going to get busy in, you know, in the matter of what the ministry is all about.
I guess I'd have to disagree with that's a traditional parish.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I you know, you can, and you justify it.
I don't know whether a worker priest would do it or not. I think that there is a really big hole as far as motivation is concerned.
Oh, very.
But
yeah. No, that's not the problem. I don't think it is.
Mary, were you finished? I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think the history of what I've read of the worker priest movement seems to show that many experiments have succeeded. Many of them are too early to judge, and some have failed. Some have failed. And perhaps the discussion could be profitably turned toward maybe discussing whether or not, under what conditions would you think, what safeguards would you build into a worker-priest arrangement to ensure that possibility of failure is minimized? Perhaps we go back to the question of definition. Would you, for example, say that it is healthy for a worker priest to be a totally volunteer, even if this being volunteer is sanctified by a document, a call arrived at a meeting? Would you say that that's...
Is that what the Nazarenes have?
I'm not sure.
The Nazarenes have something like that. They have a full-time... The pastor has a full-time job, I think he must have some kind of call, because he is, you know, he is the pastor of the congregation.
I know of a number of theologians that have come through Hong Kong. We've discussed this matter, and almost to a man, they agree that be very, very careful not to let it degenerate into something which is merely volunteer work, because all volunteer works, if you ever worked with voluntary agencies, dissipate after a while. And if you have a call document, it may take longer a little bit, but the end will probably be the same. Put differently, you say it has to be bolstered by something like a contract and sealed with a thing called money, you know, financial obligations that you have mutually. This way, if the pastor gets into any stuff that he shouldn't be doing, the congregation is in a better position to say, listen, you know, even if they withdraw the possibility of withdrawing that nominal sum that they support him with, it's a token of their mutual responsibility. Now, I don't know how you feel about this.
Very much so. I wouldn't want to go there that I'm doing it all myself. For one thing, it's unhealthy in terms of your relationship with the people. They soon resent you, what you're doing, because there's a dependency relationship there that's unhealthy. We worked always as equals, because they were providing me with things, I was providing them with things when we were together trying to carry out this ministry. I thought it was quite healthy.
Any other aspects concerning suggestions of what safeguards might be built in if your congregation is considering a worker priest?
No, I was just saying, I think the parable of the workers in the vineyard, you know, whether you work 1 hour or nine,
yeah,
you get paid, and so how do you define part-time? The work in the factory for 8 hours is our vocation is a calling, Luther's, you know, whether we're a ditch digger or whether we're the highest official.
What about the job security for the priests who, you say, if the plant closes down then? What about the tensions that arise when the worker priest, you know, becomes unemployed?
Then he's living like one of the people. Yeah, he's right in it.
To tell your people that your husband will be pretty busy this month because he's going to be looking for a job, you know, out job hunting. I think they identify with you and you identify with them more than in almost any other circumstance. Job hunting is a very, very discouraging thing to do.
And the problem is that many of the churches that could use a worker priest situation are not in good job markets, and the pickings are pretty slim. And then I lost my job and couldn't find another one, so we had to work out some other arrangement. And in the process of trying to do that, the stresses and strains in the congregation developed, because there were some who never wanted to go back to the full-time ministry again. They found the tent maker ministry exciting, and it had given them an opportunity to assume responsibility and to serve that they've never had under a full-time pastor, and they never wanted to go back to that. And we had some tensions in there between the tent makers and the ones who were willing to issue me a call. And as a result of all this tension, I finally decided the best thing I better do is get out of there, because if I couldn't stick to my original contract with them, then I could just leave rather than try and renegotiate. It was very difficult for the congregation to try and renegotiate new terms for our relationship. This was one thing I learned.
I think one of the unfortunate things is that the subject of hiring a worker priest usually doesn't come up until you have a vacant parish or something like that. And in my opinion, it would be particularly in congregations which already have one pastor, when they start thinking about having a second one, or DCE or something like that, some of them with several, three, that they ought to be the ones thinking of having team ministries with a full-time minister is in charge, but you have a beautiful setup of five or six others. But they're not thinking of it, you know, it's don't. We only think worker priest when you have a vacancy out there or a congregation that can't afford a full-time pastor.
But it's also very hard to go looking for a worker priest because if a congregation can offer maybe a house and pension benefits, which is really good, but can't offer a job, you know, I mean, it takes a long time to negotiate a new worker priest coming in, because
it is more complicated. Yeah.
You have to really, this is what we're, you know, kind of trying to work out now. We thought that you have to get that job first before you can start being available, but it's kind of sticky business.
I think it's important to remember probably that the minister or the priest's main duty is to be a leader. With all due respect to the business of, you know, he's out of a job and that's life, he is a leader. And leaders, I think by definition, have to be somewhat apart. To be respected, you're not going to look upon everyone in the same ditch with you as one of your leaders. You have to have someone that you think may know a little bit more, that you can have the confidence in, that will fill your needs, whether they be political or social in the town, or national or whatever. Okay, in this case, you're just talking about a religious leader. And you can be equal, but you have to be not equal, if you understand what I mean. So the concept of my husband is out looking for work, they'll say, oh my God, you know, well, who am I going to turn to? You know, better off than I am. And I know misery loves company, but it seems the function is to be a leader.
Well, just like, you know, like to go to somebody for counseling and marital problems, do you want to go to somebody who is also having marital problems?
What kind of example of that? You got a person who's broke for financial advice.
That gets to be real tender. You know, the big thing in chemical dependency is reformed, chemically dependent people doing the counseling, which has some real positive aspects to it. But, you know, that's just a whole other thing that...
I think getting back to some of the safeguards, I would wholeheartedly agree that the monetary aspect is not overriding, that a worker priest as a complete independent entity may not be the best arrangement. Certainly as an assistant, where he's working under the leadership, or she is working under the leadership of a full-time leader, okay, and it's an extension of that person, that would seem to be the optimum. Because then, obviously, the money is not the paramount reason for hiring. it's recognized when that person comes into the factory that they're coming in, you know, as a push from the parish rather than as the only thing in the parish. They're there and they're not in the parish house doing parish duties or whatever. So as a safeguard, I would certainly agree with you that not as a single entity, and perhaps as an assistant, as an extension. The extension aspect is the would seem to be the big advantage of the priest worker.
Should we maybe stop at this point, and if you have further questions? Okay, last one.
One last one, but the idea of keeping the man employed so that it doesn't come up, that would be a kind of a safeguard that might be worked into it. And one of these would be, after all, if you have a congregation, you have people who are in business of some kind, right? And it would seem that you have a question, that should that man be working for someone who's a member of his congregation, or should he be working for someone not a member of the congregation? Well, I realize it has some tension to be working for members of the congregation. But on the other hand, that would be one of the reasons for sure that there would be employment. That the congregation would assume the responsibility of employing this man in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're not really a regular employee. I mean, if you've got somebody kind of, you know, it's the lucky soul that happens to know the guy in business to get a job, but the regular Joes, like me, you know, we're just in the old place on the street looking for a job. And I would think that if that whole concept is going to be, you know, working Mason like others, then maybe it wouldn't be fair to have guaranteed jobs.
Or how do you control the suspicion that the members of your congregation are going
to
have?
But the congregation would have to agree to that.
Yeah, well, then maybe then the subsidy, minimum subsidy, comes from the church headquarters or something, where it's not an identifiable source, stopgap.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would think that would be much better.
Yeah. I think there's no way. I think I know what you're talking about, but I don't think there's any way you can control. I think it's it puts you in a terrible position, because there's no way you can control what people are going to say and do and how they're going to visualize your role. And I think you do have a role, whether you're a worker priest or priest, that does require a setting at least aside, not you know.
I think we all agree that the subject needs a lot more thinking and reading. And on that suggestion, I'd like to close by saying that they're particularly reading these two books. Mary, you have those titles?
One of them is, I was going to bring them down today. I will put them in the on the table in the library over there in the center. And I would prefer that you wouldn't take them out, because they're the only copies I have, and I don't even know if they're in print anymore, but at least I think just looking at them, they're both in terms of a Catholic worker priest movement, and as I say, this was a strategy against Marxism, and I think this is something we have to think about, that the worker priest movement is not just an economically feasible thing for the church. I mean, if it's going to have any value, it's got to have a mission. It's got to have a real, you know, a real thrust. And I think that's...
I agree. That's, I think, the main value. We haven't touched on that so much. We've dealt with economic questions, the call, finding employment. But one of the greatest factors on which the worker-priest movement will be judged and will be the feedback that it gets. Back, how pastors are being educated by working side by side with others, and particularly if it's as blue collar workers.
Particularly part of your discussion on ultimate seminary education. I mean, if sometimes part of the internships maybe
mm-hmm.
could be done.
Yeah. Okay, so read the book. We're going to have it here.
Take a look at them. I'll put them down in the. They're not really applicable to our society in the same way, but I think they give us insight into some of the things that both France and Germany went through.
Thank you. Your questions have been very good. Your contributions.
Thank you.